I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, and welcome to episode 41 of the Renaissance English History Podcast. And in this podcast, Benjamin Redding and I are going to talk about boats. So I'm going to introduce him in a second, but he is a PhD candidate whose expertise is in the Tudor Navy. And I first came across him when I was doing research for the episode on the Tudor Navy. So this kind of completes that circle. And we talk about boat building and grappling and lots of other things, maritime exploration. But before I get started on that, two pieces of admin. The first is that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network, which is a group of independent podcasters who all kind of promote each other to make podcasting more popular in general. So this month, the podcast that we're promoting is The American Biography, which is the American story told through Americans' stories. And it's a podcast that's essentially biographies of not necessarily the most famous people in American history, but other civic leaders, cabinet members, and other people who drove American policy. So check that out on iTunes, The American Biography, or you can also go to americanbiography.webs.com. And then the other piece of admin is that there are show notes available on the website, englandcast.com. And while you're there, do be sure to sign up for the mailing list. Mailing list subscribers get all kinds of free extra mini casts and giveaway opportunities, exclusive content and things like that. And it doesn't cost anything. It's totally free. And I won't ever spam you or sell your email address. Usually I send out about one, maybe two newsletters a month. So check it out at englandcast.com. All right. And without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Benjamin Redding now. So Benjamin Redding is a final year PhD candidate in history at the University of Warwick. His research project, under the provisional title Divided by La Manche, Naval Enterprise and Maritime Revolution in England and France, 1545 to 1642, is kindly funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. This project evaluates the relationship between navy and state in early modern England and France. His thesis considers naval development through administrative and financial advancements, quantitative growth, and visual representation. He is also an undergraduate tutor for early modern history and is currently working on a journal article which considers naval development in Marian and early Elizabethan England. And so a big thank you to Benjamin Redding for being here with the Renaissance English History Podcast today. I'm really excited to talk to you. And so, thank you for being here. And hopefully we'll get a lot of information covered. So I'm going to dive right in and ask you the big million-dollar question to start with, which is if you can summarize the changes in the Tudor Navy in the 16th century and how those changes reflect the larger shifts in the monarchy and society. And like I said in my question to you, I know that could make up an entire book. So however you can do it would be wonderful.
Yes, indeed. No problem. Well, as you say, there's been... You can easily write a book on this, and there has been several books written on this. So how to go through this in as short a time as possible? Well, of course, Tudor period, there's 5 different monarchs, starting off with Henry VII, ending with Elizabeth. All experienced the navy in different ways, perceived it for different things. Some utilised it, some didn't really have any interest in it whatsoever. And so it really is about a change of policy rather than being a singular continuing policy for out. Of course, when the Navy starts with Henry VII, he develops a small interest in the Navy. He develops the dry port at Portsmouth. And actually, by the end of his reign, where in 1509, his son is able to inherit between 5 and 6 vessels. And these were all reasonably large vessels, actually. We have vessels such as the Regent and the Sovereign, these most famous ones. And these vessels would continue into Henry's reign and be used in warfare. So Henry already had some vessels to utilise, which is more than his father could have wished for when in 1485. So, and it's always interesting because Henry VIII is now being perceived as the father of the Navy, and it's certainly fair enough to depict him in that way. Henry had a huge passion for the Navy. We know that pretty definitively from the records. In fact, when he was young, there's a particular account of Henry on one of his vessels when it's being launched. This vessel was the Great Galley, and Henry is depicted in it as jumping up and down in joy as he's controlling this vessel. He supposedly has a golden whistle that was engraved on it. Hit the famous monarchy's motto, which still endures today, Je ai mon droit, God is my right. It still continues, and Henry has a huge interest in it. You can see basically in this account that Henry's a huge child towards the Navy. He enjoys it. He enjoys being on these vessels. They're a sign of power, and they're also a bit of fun for him, really.
It's like a toy or something, huh? Like a gadget.
Absolutely, a toy indeed, a rather large toy at that. Yes, indeed. And we do know that Henry loved warfare. Of course, he's inspired to be like Henry V, the warrior king of Agincourt. In fact, when Henry was young and he was being protected in the Tower of London during a rebellion, during the Cornish Rebellion, I believe. When he was young, he found influence in and fascination in the artillery there. He found an active interest in it, and we believe that that's really one of the foundations of this interest there. And so, yes, by the end of Henry's reign, there are around 58 warships in his fleet. So the fleet had expanded by around 50 vessels. And some of these enormous vessels, the Henri Glace Azure, also commonly known as the Great Harry. It was a vessel that, believed when it was first launched, was as much as 1,500 tonnes. But whereas on the other end of this, there was around 15 to 20 vessels known as row barges that could only be manned by the most, perhaps 10, 20 people at the same time.
I was going to ask you how it's measured, because is there consistency within the measurements, and how do we know exactly how big
they
are?
Yes, absolutely not. No consistency whatsoever. It's a long history to how these vessels were measured. The origin of the word ton, spelt T-U-N as opposed to the metric ton T-O-N. The origin of that term was actually founded in 14th century France in Bordeaux. And a ton was actually a measurement of wine. I believe at the top of my head, a ton was around 250 gallons. And how vessels were measured was how many of these crates were 250 gallons in size, how many of them could be stored on a vessel, how many could be put on. And so the origin of the word ton, and how when we say a vessel was, say, 1,500 tons, what we actually mean is that there was someone who estimated how many of these cargoes, how many of these tons could actually fit on a vessel itself. Now, things did change, though, during this period, and it does get complicated, because by the time we get to Elizabeth I's reign, there is a particular shipwright known as Matthew Baker. And Matthew Baker founded a new rule on how vessels should be measured. And he created the scheme known as Baker's Rule, which was based on measuring the depth of the ship, the length of the ship, the width of the ship, and from that he'd be able to determine how what the size of a vessel was. But instead of being measured in tons T-U-N, it was measured in tons T-O-N instead.
Oh my gosh.
Which is why this is a rather complicated area.
Wow.
But after you do, after Baker's rule is established, vessels therefore do have a kind of criteria to meet, and we can see a scale of accuracy in their measurement thereafter.
I see.
Baker's rule is really being used by around 1580. And so by the 17th century, pretty much, if you see a measurement of a vessel, you could expect that that's utilising a form of Baker's rule within it. And so they are, you can compare a vessel of, let's say, 1,200 tons in England, in, I don't know, say Brighton or something, with a vessel the same tonnage in London, and assume that it's the same size. Whereas if you were to do that 50, 60 years earlier, these estimates of vessel size would be made by different people. And of course, therefore, it's guesswork, and you can presume they're probably of a different size with that said. Yes.
Okay. Sorry to sidetrack you there.
That's fine. Yes, so of course, so Henry, I think we're talking about.
So you were talking Henry's, about, yeah, what he had.
Yes. By the time of Henry's death, 1547, there's around 58 vessels in the Navy, some a lot larger than others. The smallest vessels were called row barges, were really developed as a temporary kind of vessel to increase the size of Henry's fleet when they were competing against the French. That's really their only purpose. Mm. And so when Henry dies and his son takes over, most of these row barges are sold off within the first 1 or 2 years because there's basically no use for them. And so by the time of Edward's death, there are the quantitative number of vessels within the fleet are significantly less, perhaps around 30 vessels it gone down to. That's also because these vessels were kind of neglected under Edward, and similarly also under Mary I. Neither monarch had that great of an interest in the Navy when compared to someone like Henry VIII. And because of that, the numbers really begin to drop. And it's really not until around 1556 that when Mary marries Philip II of Spain, this begins to change again, because Philip mm-hmm. realises that England has potential for a navy, and he encourages Mary to begin developing her navy again. And so within the space of between 1556 and her death, around 4, 5, 6 vessels have been built, and including a vessel named the Mary Rose Arthur, of course, the more famous Mary Rose vessel. So we have multiple vessels being named the same thing here.
So that makes your job really easy when you're doing all the research, right?
Absolutely. One of the major issues, actually, is determining whether a vessel made in 1510 was the same vessel declared in, say, 1530 under the same name, or rather that vessel's actually been completely rebuilt and redesigned in its totality. Yes, it's very difficult to determine. Very difficult. In fact, perhaps impossible most of these occasions. Yes, so of course, by the time that Elizabeth I inherits the throne, not only does she inherit also a war with France, which of course Philip had dragged Mary into, but she also develops a navy that's being redeveloped again. And she takes that in its stead and really, really develops it. She realises that many of the vessels in her navy are actually rather rotted and neglected, and decommissions them, gets rid of them. And eventually, and slowly over the next 15 years, replaces them with a really strong fleet of newly developed vessels. And skipping ahead slightly, of course, just slightly before the Armada, we have Sir John Hawkins in 1577 taking over the Navy as taken over the Council of Marine Courses as the treasurer of the Navy. And he completely revamps the Navy, develops new architecture for vessels, and develops what we often associate as the race-built galleon type of vessel, which was sleeker and faster and more manoeuvrable than those before it. And so the Elizabethan Navy really was quite advanced for its time when it encountered the Armada.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, that the other question I had was, like, the policies between Henry and Elizabeth, and it seems like Elizabeth was really forward thinking. Is that because of that there was always, like, this threat to her that Henry didn't have as much, or what propelled her forward so much with that?
I'd say absolutely not, really. In my opinion, Henry was his own threat. Henry made his own wars, whereas Elizabeth wasn't seeking warfare in the same kind of fashion. And Henry really seen the Navy as a status piece. It was his opportunity to make England great, to give himself a name. And so that's really why the Navy developed, because he did have an interest in it, because he saw it as an opportunity to advance his own image. Whereas I don't really believe that Elizabeth had so much of an impact on the Navy. Yes, the Navy is most famous during that period, but the reason why is perhaps because of the individuals who surrounded her at that point. I mean, of course, we have to remember that Elizabeth was a woman, and so she never was expected to have a military presence as a father was to have. She wasn't going to be depicted as a warrior queen in the same way that her father wished to be a warrior king. But nevertheless, the Navy had developed so much in the last 50 years through her father and her brother and sister that it developed a huge community of merchants and mariners and generally individuals who were interested in maritime knowledge. And it was these people she could use and she could trust as to be her advisors to guide and lead the Navy. People like Sir John Hawkins, like Francis Drake, like Walter Raleigh, something that her father didn't necessarily do in the same frame, because her father was very much a hands-on man who believed that it was his Navy and the Navy should be directed according to his command, according to his order. The Navy was very much just a product of the state at that point, Henry, whereas Elizabeth perceived her Navy as being something more about the knowledge of the merchant marine community around her.
Sorry, I didn't mean to So, so you were talking, we were still kind of on the first question with just the shifts in the monarchy and society as a whole. And it's so interesting to me. This period seems to be all about this kind of move from a medieval world to a modern world that we would recognize more. And the Navy seems to be such a great example of that, with this move away from the warfare techniques of the medieval age with the grappling, like I know you want to talk about, and then, you know, having these newer ships and having more of the maritime exploration and recognizing the world. And so, you know, do you think that the Navy is sort of a reflection for the changes in society as a whole in the 16th century?
Yes. Yeah, so the Navy was actually really kind of the leader in some of these developments. What it actually done was reformed how administration was governed. And so when by 1603, when we as historians, we as the outsider look back at what naval administration was by 1603, we can see a lot of comparisons to our own world that was not comparable in 1509 or even 1585. For example, so when Henry VIII succeeded to the throne and inherited his father's navy, there was only one full-time permanent administrative figure for the Navy, and that was a man called Robert Brigadine, who was the clerk of the king's ships. He was the only person who really maintained the Navy in that sense. Yet slowly, as Henry decided he wanted to expand his Navy, naturally there needed to be more and more people to run the Navy. And so more offices slowly developed, treasurers, surveyors, general clerks as well on top of that. And what actually happened in 1545, we had the establishment of what we called the Council of Marine Causes. And the Council of Marine Causes would actually later be known as the Navy Board. And so the Navy Board, the Council of Marine Causes, was, when founded in 1545, a council of six principal officers who all had a particular job to do within the upkeep of the Navy. It's been argued by historians such as Clifford Davies that this really was the emergence of a bureaucratic idea of governance, perhaps the first type of its kind, because we have a council meeting to discuss their ideas, but at the same time, they've all got their own jobs to do. They've all got their own departments to run, to operate, to keep the Navy in function. And this is really important because in 1545 or 1546, Henry, of course, is getting very ill, famously very fat, and he can't do much in terms of run the Navy himself, in terms of have an active interest in it. And so the Council of Marine Causes really takes his place. And when we get to Edward's reign and Mary's reign, the Council of Marine Causes is able to continue the Navy despite the two monarchs not necessarily having that much of an interest in it. So the Council of Marine Causes is so very important as an idea of administration that did not necessarily rely completely upon the monarch for its occupation, for its use. So that's very
important. Yeah, so it's like a branch of government that is, that's not as dependent on the monarch. And was that kind of like the first time you see something like that? I like, from what you're saying, it sounds like it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's often argued that anyway. Yes, indeed. Indeed.
And in any country in Europe or just in England?
Absolutely. You know. It's pretty much unique. Some historians such as Nicholas Rogers have argued that we might be able to reflect on similarities in Venice, for example, but Venice is completely on the decline by this point, so it's perhaps not that important in that sense. And so, yeah, if you're going to look at the two other great powers at this point, so France and Spain, both powers operate their navy through relying on its nobility only, and it's the Navy is run in a deeply personal fashion where the monarch dictates policy and the nobility are there to enforce it. There is no network, there is no administrative body like the Council of Marine Corps anywhere else in that sense. So absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Interesting. And do you think that's part of like what makes the English Navy so unique and so special?
100
this time period?
Yes, 100%. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's just one of the reasons why the Navy was able to maintain itself and be classed as a standing Navy. Certainly, if you compare it to someone like France did not have a standing Navy by this point. In fact, France didn't really have a standing Navy until as late as maybe the mid-17th century. So we're talking about a century before England was leading the way by having a standing navy because it had an administrative infrastructure to ensure that it was maintained. And by 1557, I believe, the Council of Marine Corps had a standard annual budget of £8,000. It was given every year for the upkeep of the navy. So it didn't even have to request finance to keep it operating. It was given this automatically.
That's really amazing. So that kind of answers one of the other questions I was going to ask you about why the French or Spanish didn't develop in the same way and, you know, kind of what makes the English Navy so unique.
There's several reasons for it, really. Of course, that is one really pivotal reason. But others is the fact that we have to remember that England is an island. And that's hugely reflecting its identity. Whereas powers like Spain and France, they could still, their main military force was the army, because they didn't need a navy to sail across the shore to transport any troops in the same way. They could compete in the Italian wars through just walking across land to do so, where England did not have that luxury to do so. It needed to develop a navy to transport troops. In order to engage with the continent and the wider world, it had to have vessels to transport it. So that's so important. Other reasons are the fact of how the nation's geographical layout, its topography, how it actually was located, because England was very lucky in that the Thames is such a very large river that made access to London quite easy. And so the navy, its dockyard, could be situated very close to London itself. So, of course, the two main dockyards that we developed at this around the 16th century are Deptford and Chatham. And these are huge dockyards based in Kent, so very near to London, which meant that when we had the counter-marine courses, for example, they could correspond with the actual dockyards in a very simple and easy way. They could communicate easily. Whereas France never had anything like that. Of course, France's capital, Paris. Paris was located in the centre of France, and its main river was not easy to navigate. It could not get large vessels down it in the same fashion. And so its navy couldn't be centred on Paris.
Right, and the same for Spain, too. I live in Andalusia, and it's funny when I think about how Columbus left from Seville, and I look at Seville, and it's like, there's a river here? Really? Like, you can't even see it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you also need to remember that countries like France and Spain have coasts that look on at many other different hostile countries. If you look at France, not only has it got to compete against the English and Northern Europe, but it's also got the southern coast, which is divided by Iberia, by Spain, which means because of that France needed two separate navies, one in the south and one in the north, which means it couldn't be centralised in the same way that somewhere like London was with the navy.
Right. And then, of course, the northern border with Scotland didn't necessarily need a navy so much because it's narrower and it's a land border, so it's not like you needed a navy there. So
absolutely.
I see what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is completely one reason for it. The other reason is that Scotland's navy diminished. After maybe 1615, 1620, so early on in Henry's reign, Scotland didn't really have a navy anymore. In fact, what first happened in Scotland, it developed vessels in around 1510, such as the Great Michael, which was a huge vessel. Yet these vessels were too costly to maintain. And because of that, it sold them to France. And so Scotland did not have a navy to really compete against the English equivalent. And so there was no need to have a navy up north.
Yeah. Interesting. And so then the way religion played out in England, did that have anything to do with the way I know you mentioned like Mary and her marriage to Philip, of course, would have influenced the way the navy was created. But did the English religious experience was so different than in France and in Spain? And I just wonder whether any of that had anything to do, whether that's tied to it at all.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we can even trace this. If you look at the great crisis of the late 1520s and early 1530s surrounding Henry's divorce, Henry was actually that busy and occupied at this point that the navy was not even really recorded. There's very little actually happening for the navy. But this would actually change when all these issues were resolved, and most importantly, when France and Spain entered an alliance in the late 1530s, because of course there was an invasion scare in 1538-9, and this clearly was very, very pivotal to the navy, because for the first time really since in the 1530s, the navy is being rebuilt again. We have vessels like we had the Mary Rose, we had Peter Pomegranate, we have the Henri Grasset all being rebuilt, all being re-established. But because they know this threat is coming, of course, this threat was just a scare. It did not come to fruition. But the Navy was certainly developing because of that. And really, after 1538, after the invasion scare that was supposedly developed because Spain and France weren't happy about what Henry was doing with the church. After that, when we go into the 1540s, that is really the time of the Navy for Henry VIII. That is when the Navy really comes into development. Absolutely, absolutely. And the other important thing to remember is that England, at least with Elizabeth, is seen as a Protestant nation. And that shapes its identity. And that means that when people were going over to the Americas, the reason behind it is because that we want to establish a Protestant colony, a Protestant location for exploration. I think that's very important, that idea of a religious identity attached to this maritime expansion in that sense. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Interesting, interesting. So that would either take us to maritime exploration or to the artillery. Let's just go with maritime exploration then. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, the English experience? I know they came at it later than the French or the Spanish and the Portuguese, and then with that, they had a more of a unique experience with heading north and the Muscovy Company and all of that, and then North America. So what can you tell me about that?
Mm. Yes, I mean, first of all, you know, this is a time where we have this idea of mercantilism really being developed, the idea that the state is going to support great companies developing to develop trade, and then the state's going to reel in the profits from it, reel in the benefits from it. And so it is important. You mentioned the Muscovy Company. So yeah, the Muscovy Company was first founded on not because of an idea of trade, but because of the idea of exploration. It was, if I remember right, around 1551. There's Richard Chancellor, Sebastian Cabot, and most famously Sebastian Cabot and Sir Hugh Willoughby. And they're actually trying to find a northeast passage to China. They're not trying to find Russia. But, of course, they get stuck and it fails. But they do encounter the region of Muscovy and, more importantly, Moscow itself. And they're able to begin trading. They do, of course, England's main export is wool. And in exchange, they receive the kind of luxury furs from the Russian region. And so it's really welcome, this idea of trade. And so by 1555, Mary I has given these three, actually it's not these three individuals, just one of them has died Richard Chancellor, I believe. It was Hugh Willoughby died trying to find the passage to China. He froze to death, unfortunately. But yes, the other...
And did they find the ships? Didn't like Russian fishermen find the ships and they were all just in place frozen?
Yes, indeed. Supposedly they found Sir Hugh Willoughby and he was frozen solid. But he was frozen solid along with all his crewmates. And it's one of these mysteries that survived today as to what actually happened, why he actually died. Because I think there's actually a theory that it wasn't actually just a cold that killed him. It was actually, I think I've even heard it was carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah, like they were trying to burn stuff.
Exactly.
And
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Of course, being in a closed space, it's not a good thing to do. Yes. So 1555, the company is established. And so trade between England and Russia kind of starts to flourish. But there's also disadvantages to it because England gets a bit greedy and it. By around 1570, it's asking Russia if it will trade with England in exclusivity, without Russia actually trading with any other European nation, which Russia is not too happy about, and actually for a while at least, kind of trade really stopped between the two parties. and it never really recovers properly after that point. We still had the company in existence until the Commonwealth period, but it never really peaks again. And one could link it to that kind of occasion then, because after that period, there was very much an anti-English sentiment by the Russians. So yes, it was a... The Muscovy Company was a intriguing time. It was an intriguing event because it was one of the foundations that would lead to Elizabeth creating the Virginia Company and the East India Company in the final year of her reign. And the kind of charters are very much similar to the Muscovy Company's original one in 1555. Yes. Yes, but is that, if we're going to look at America, it worked in exactly the same way. Any ideas of kind of creating these trade links, or even colonies themselves, they all developed because of the desire to explore, first of all. Of course, the most famous example is supposedly Virginia, the founding of Virginia, and of course it was supposedly named Virginia because of Elizabeth's virginity. But there was also a kind of anti-Spanish sentiment to it. Why should Spain have all the power and wealth? And so the Navy becomes quite pivotal to it. There's even theories and strategies that never came into actual fruition that England should try and create a naval blockade that prevented the Spanish flotillas from ever actually making the full trip from the Americas to Spain.
And that then plays into, or leads into my questions about Drake and piracy. And did other countries have like a Drake?
El Draco. Well, Drake is famous or infamous, of course. Did they have other alternatives to him? Perhaps I'm being slightly favoritist and implying that they didn't know, but England was certainly not unique in endorsing pirates in that way. That's what we to call them, of course, pirates or privateers. There's a very thin line between them. The idea of privateers is that they're state sanctioned, that they're state endorsed, whereas pirates are not state endorsed, and that's quite important because when Spain accused Drake of being a pirate, of course England would say no, he's not, he's a privateer, because he's being sanctioned by the state, because he's being supported by us. And so there's a difference there, but no, absolutely not. It's Drake was not unique in that he was not the only kind of these pirates are not the only people, the only kind of people being patronised by a state such as England. The main kind of example is in France. Of course, France during this period is undergoing a huge civil war, the French Wars of Religion, and there's a separate admiralty ship in Guienne, which is in the hands of Henri de Navarre, who would later become Henri IV of France. And Henri of Navarre would issue what we call congés, which was literally a contract for the holder of the contract to go out and pillage and exact revenge for prizes. And so Navarre done this, and also another Protestant prince, the Prince of Condé, also regularly released these contracts. And it wasn't only to Frenchmen. We know that Englishmen also received these contracts from these Protestant autonomous states at this point. So it wasn't only something for England, although, of course, England will be notoriously known for it thereafter.
Right. Interesting. What else about kind of, is there anything else about exploration that you want to add in here that I haven't asked?
what have you not asked? Of course, another thing that is developing at this point, of course, we've looked at Russia and the Americas slightly, but there's the old trade routes. So Venice, Venice is still important to England. Venice is actually really a huge influence for England's idea of what a maritime state should be like. And although Venice is on the decline at this point, and England is certainly taking advantage of that, English sailors are very often found in the Mediterranean, still trading with the Venetians, and even with the Ottomans at this period. So, of course, the Ottomans are a huge maritime power, and not only a maritime power, but a piratical power as well. And one of the reasons why England had to arm the seas so very often is because of the piratical threat of the Ottomans.
Mm-hmm. And that's the whole, like, the Battle of Lepanto and everything with that, right?
Yes, indeed, yes. England didn't actually participate in the Battle of Lepanto, but yeah, the idea around it was that it's a huge Catholic coalition organised by the Pope, or at least sanctioned, by, at least endorsed by the Pope. Right. And it's against the Ottomans. Of course, the Catholic side win. And it's quite important, that battle, because it was a battle primarily fought through galleys. And that's something we haven't really talked about. We should. So for those of you.
Look at that segue. It's almost like I planned that.
Indeed, yes. galleys. So the galleys were oared vessels, one-tier vessels largely, designed in the Mediterranean, where, of course, in the Mediterranean, the sea was far calmer. And so oared propulsion was far more utilizable. And so the galleys were used as opposed to sailing vessels that were used in England in the north. And the Battle of Lepanto is seen as really kind of the climax of the age of galleys. And really, after Lepanto in 1571, galleys are really on the decline, and sailing vessels, which of course can go all the way across the Americas, which an oared vessel, hey, I would want to be the person rowing a vessel right across the Atlantic. So yes, Lepanto is seen as the end of the galley vessel, the end of this kind of classic medieval vessel. And what takes its place is the sailing vessel, which of course most of the English fleet does consist of sailing vessels, and it's not oared propulsion. Uh-huh. Although, with this said, Elizabeth, for reasons beyond me, decided in the last years of her reign to build 5 galleys in her fleet, and which is bizarre because, to my knowledge, there was not a single galley in her fleet during the Armada period. Huh. And yet, in these final years, she builds them. I can't understand why, because they were never used. They basically sat there. In fact, they were still in the Navy in 1525, and they'd not been used for the last 25 years, to my knowledge, at all.
Wow.
And so,
you mean, oh, 1625, yeah.
Sorry, okay. 1625, yes, 1625. Yeah. So when Charles takes over, he realised that there's these galleys here and finally decommissions them. After having sat stagnant there for all these years. So I really cannot answer why these galleys were built. I don't think there's a true reason for it, other than perhaps Elizabeth realised that, hey, there isn't any galleys in my fleet. Maybe I should build some to make it appear more robust. Who knows? Who knows?
Interesting. Just with the changes in the galleys, then, what about the changes in the way people fought and in the way battles were fought with grappling versus artillery?
Yeah, excellent point. And it kind of follows on from the galley element, because galleys, as they were all propulsion, they could not really use artillery down in the depths, mainly for one reason, because they only had one tier, but for other reasons, the fact that the oars got in the way of when you were trying to shoot. And so galleys still did use grappling tactics, the idea of lining 2 ships together and then fighting in hand-to-hand combat. That was still typical of galley warfare. And it was no different for much of this period, that sailing vessels done the same. The idea was that 2 vessels would come together, grapple each other and pull each other so close that the two crews could board each other and fight hand-to-hand combat until one or another was defeated. Yes, and this is quite important because this change was very, very gradual, that we moved from hand-to-hand combat on ships to long-distance tactics. Very, very gradual indeed. We can say perhaps that the kind of pivotal moment was in the early 16th century, when there's a famous battle, the Battle of Saint-Malo, in which a French and an English vessel lined up, grappled each other, and then a fire broke out on the French vessel and spread to the English vessel, and both vessels went down, killing most of the crew with it. So yeah, clearly that was a sign that this tactic wasn't the most efficient of one's crew and resources. And it wasn't the only time. A couple of years later, in 1513, there was another occasion where this grappling technique was used with an English and French vessel, and the admiral, the Lord High Admiral, who at this point was Sir Edward Howard. Sir Edward Howard. He went aboard this vessel and started fighting hand-to-hand combat, but then suddenly the grapples somehow broke off on the ships, and Howard's vessel slowly disappeared into the distance without him.
And then he's just stuck.
He was stuck and stranded. He was stuck and stranded indeed. And we don't know completely what happened next, except for the fact that his body was eventually found floating in the water. So one way or another, he was killed.
Oh.
And so, yes, another sign that this tactic was not a very good one, shall we say.
Right.
But,
and so
it was continued nevertheless. And the reason behind it is, by grappling, there was an opportunity to get more benefit from it. By grappling, you could capture a vessel, right, and then integrate it into your navy, pillage it of resources. And so it was more financially viable to do that rather than just shoot at a vessel until it sinks and achieve nothing as a result.
Interesting. I see. So there was a positive to grappling, why they would want to keep it.
Absolutely.
Going.
And that is why it's still a preferred tactic for the privateers, even in Elizabeth's reign.
Uh-huh.
Even though we do have what perhaps we could even say the origin of the broadside tactic, meaning the idea of deploying one side of a vessel's artillery simultaneously at the same time at a single vessel. We do believe that perhaps developed in Elizabeth's reign. Yes. So even though that's occurring, there was long after still this idea of, if we can grapple with them, let's try and do it, because it's the more financially viable thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I'm thinking also about, I did an episode, a podcast episode on the Wealden iron industry and the cannon that they were creating there with the blast iron furnace. And I was thinking about that in the Navy, and it seems like this development, like one pushed the other with the artillery as well. Like the being able to have these less expensive cannon would push wanting to use them if you had them, but then that would push the development of ships that could use them, I suppose. Is there anything like that you found?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing you have to remember straight away is cannons are very, very heavy things.
Yeah.
And so before integrating them within vessels in any significant number, you need to ensure that the vessel's architecture was suitable so that it could sustain them. And
sure.
So before you could even cut out a hole within a vessel's hull so that a cannon could protrude from it, you need to actually ensure that the vessel was stable enough to be able to hold these cannons and to be able to have a hole cut out of it in the first place.
I see.
And so what actually happens is there is a, I guess one could call it a revolution in naval architecture during the very early 16th century, and it was certainly fully in full stream by the 1530s, 1540s period. And what this development was is we went through what we call a clinker de- idea of shipbuilding to a cargo development. And this meant that how vessels were originally constructed in the medieval period was that a plank of wood was literally nailed over to on top of another, i.e. it was overlapping another piece of wood, and they would just slowly build these planks up to build the outside of the ship, to build the hull. So these planks were overlapping. And this caused huge problems if you're going to integrate artillery on a ship, because if you cut a hole within a vessel which was clinker built, it could seriously weaken the structure of the vessel, because each plank wasn't kind of sitting on the plank in front below it. Instead, it was merely placed on top of it. So by cutting a hole out, it was going to weaken the ship structure and perhaps ultimately destroy it. And so what happened instead was this new development called carvel building. And what this was is the idea that a ship's spine was constructed first and its ribs. So you would build the skeleton of a ship first. And from that, you would then place planks of wood on the ribs, nail them on, and instead of having the planks overlapping each other, they were instead just laid next to each other. So they were on top of each other rather than laying on top of each other, if that makes any sense. And what this done is made it far easier to cut a hole out of the ship's hull, because you could cut the hole and yet still have these planks sitting on top of each other, resting on each other in a far more kind of architecturally strong way. And so that was important. And it really was very important, because it allowed the artillery to slowly be integrated into the hull of a ship more and more, which meant that artillery, heavy artillery, could be used more and more within the vessel. And we do kind of know when this development was coming about because of the architecture of the Mary Rose herself.
And I was just going to ask you to tell me about the Mary Rose as well. So
okay.
You're reading my mind.
The construction of Mary Rose is carvel built, whereas other parts of it is clinker. The actual top decks are clinker, so this old structure, whereas the below decks were carvel, which says that there was a known appreciation of how carvel could be used. They knew that if you're going to integrate artillery below a deck, it needed to be carvel, whereas those on the top of a vessel weren't really going to have heavy artillery protruding from it, especially with a vessel the size of the Mary Rose, because it would hit nothing.
Sure. So tell me about the Mary Rose then, and what makes the story so special.
Right. Well, the interesting thing about the Mary Rose, well, one of the many interesting things, is that we don't actually know for certain if the plans for it were developed under Henry VIII or actually his father. It was certainly being built in 1510, which implies, therefore, that the idea of building her was around in 1509. So it could very easily have been one of Henry VII's last things he'd done to commission this vessel to be constructed. Mm-hmm. We don't know that for certain. But nevertheless, one of the reasons why she's so important in that sense is because she survived throughout almost the entirety of Henry VIII's reign, of course, missing out in that final year and a half because she sank in 1545. But she really is a vessel of Henry VIII himself in that sense. Her name is very important as well. Again, we don't know for certain why she was named what she was. There's many theories around it. The first one being the Mary Rose was named after his sister, who he loved. Another explanation for the name is that she might have been named after the Virgin Mary. But there's also some kind of significance in the fact that she's named Rose, because Rose could again be linked to the idea of the Tudor dynasty and what the rose represents within that. Mm-hmm. So we don't know exactly why the name was chosen, but that's some of the options as to why it could have been.
So we don't know a lot about the her commissioning or her name. What do we know about her?
Right. Well, she was a large vessel. She wasn't the largest of Henry's fleet, but she was in the top five, shall we say, for most of his reign. She was around 600 tons. So she was big, and she was one of Henry's favourites. She was often chosen as the flagship of the fleet, despite there being vessels such as the Henri Glace Azure, what was larger. Mm-hmm. Why is the Mary Rose so famous is another question, and I don't think there's necessarily a historically appropriate answer for that, because perhaps why she's so famous is the fact that she survives till today in some kind of way, and also the fact that she sunk and we know where she sunk now, and we can access her. Because surely something like Henry's largest vessel, the Henri Glace Azure, should have been perhaps known as more famous because of its size and the fact that it was meant to represent the king in itself. Mm-hmm. But no, it's not. If you talk about the Tudor vessel today, perhaps the Mary Rose is the first one that comes to most people's mind. And I think that's because of what the Mary Rose really provides for us today in its archaeological evidence. It really provides us with a knowledge that we didn't have before on how people lived during this period, and most importantly, how people lived on these vessels. Mm. The fact we have backgammon games within it, and cook pots, and and of course various skeletons, and the skeletons are very important as well, because the skeletons tell us a lot about about life on board ships. For example, the fact that the heavy lifting of some of the artillery actually crushed some of the kneecaps of the men utilising them. Also, we know from the skeletons that we could identify exactly who the archers are because of a particular bone within the shoulder that usually only fully forms during the late teenage years. And yet we can tell from the skeletons that it's corroded, it hasn't actually formed, because they were using the longbow, because the force that was required to the longbow prevented this bone from ever completely developing. So being a man of the military in Tudor England was not good for your health, mm-hmm. in that sense. So it's fascinating like that. So I really think the Mary Rose gives us a great glimpse into the world of Tudor England, perhaps more than we've ever been able to achieve before she was recovered in 1582. Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing all this. I'm looking over my list of questions here, and I think I have asked everything that was on my list. Is there anything that you would like to put in here that I haven't?
We could talk a little bit more about the size of vessels.
Okay.
Because that's very important. Because we talk about propaganda, okay?
Okay. I missed that part.
the size of vessels is very important in propaganda, okay? Because in the male mindset, size is great, right? And size equates to power. Mm-hmm. And that is the image that one was wanted to be portrayed. So when we have vessels, most famously the Henri Glace Azure, for example, which was reportedly when first made 1,500 tons in size. The reason why she was so big is not because, big therefore meant that she was going to be the best ship in the seas. No, instead the reason why is because Henry wanted to outdo all his rivals. Mm-hmm. Henry built the Henri Glace Azure probably because he'd seen James IV, the Scottish king's ship, the Great Michael, which was probably 1,000 tons, and he didn't want to be outdone by the Scottish, and so he built this ship of a larger size. And what is a truly humorous and phenomenal fact for me is that when this ship was launched, Francis I heard of the size of this ship. And so Francis I of France decided to commission his own ship, what was going to be even larger. And so this happened around 1520. And he built this vessel called Le Grand François. And the vessel supposedly was 2,000 tons. And it was, and he claimed it could hold 2,000 men to equivalent that. Mm-hmm. But the vessel was that large that it was impossible to get her out of port. And they never got her out of port, to my knowledge. And she ended up having to, she ended up being stagnant in port for about 10 years and then was hit by lightning and destroyed.
Well, that's a good use of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. A fantastic use. But that's what it was all about. Mm-hmm. Size equated to money, and money equates to power, right?
Right.
And that's so very important, not only to, as a deterrent to your rivals, but also to your kingdom. So you got to remember, a ship is one of the only things that can be transported across the whole kingdom so that everyone can actually see the power of the monarch.
Mm-hmm.
By looking at this vessel, of course no one's ever actually seen Henry, but by some people getting a glimpse of this vessel, it inferred the power that was represented with the vessel, with the monarch itself.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it's so important that the vessel was named really after Henry. In that sense, yeah. It's great. It's great there. Hmm. It's so, size is very important, and it was for Henry, despite the Henri Gratigeur really actually being quite a useless vessel for most of this period. It was caught by poor weather, and at various times had to go into port for a repair because of this. And what would actually happen in around 1538-ish, so when the invasion scare is occurring, the Henri Gratigeur is brought into the dockyard and reduced in size to about 1,000 tons instead.
Oh, wow. So it's more seaworthy. It's able to do more. Yeah. Interesting. Yes.
Indeed.
So, yeah. So it's almost like a 16th century arms race.
Yeah. Yes, you could absolutely call it that. Absolutely. Yeah. And the reason why England won against France really is because of what would happen to France domestically. So Elizabeth's main kind of rival, well, for the first year of her reign, was Henri II of France, and he really had developed the French fleet. It was certainly comparable to the English equivalent. But after Henri II, the French Wars of Religion occur, and the navy is completely demolished in France, which means that France no longer needs to serve as a contender against the English opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, who comes next? The Spanish. Sad that.
At this point in the interview, my internet started going completely wonky, and we kind of thought that was a sign to stop anyway, because we'd gone on for an hour. So I want to really thank Benjamin Redding. I really got a lot out of this interview, and I'm sure that he is going to be a historian and historian to watch here in the future. So I don't know, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, when he's doing programs on naval history on the BBC, you can say, I first heard him on the Renaissance English History podcast, right? So keep that in mind. And, do follow him as his career progresses. And I'm so glad that he was able to be on the show. So the next episode, we're going to start to focus on the theater, as I have said. I'm going to start a little theater module. But I was so lucky and fortunate that Alison Weir agreed to be interviewed for this podcast as well. So I'm going to wind up adding in the Alison Weir interview and then going on to the theater from that. So I know in the last episode I said that we were going to have Benjamin Redding and then we were going to do the theater, and I'm deviating from that. And I do apologize, but, it's not every day you get a chance to talk to Alison Weir for half an hour. And so we're going to put that in and then move on to the theater after that. So thank you so much for listening. I know it's been a long one, and I do appreciate your listenership. And thanks again to Benjamin Redding, and check out the show notes at englandcast.com. All right. Thanks so much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.